at you, Miles.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650, live from the Kintec studio. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. The hotline is brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call, and we now go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline, where we are joined by Kevin Woodley, who, of course, is a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. Kevin from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine joining us now. Kevin, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. You know, what a sports weekend. I'll take it, right?
What a sports weekend.
I feel sorry for Granter. I heard you talking earlier about having a, you know, I used to be one of those guys that wanted a beat job that travels, and now I don't know how the hell you guys do it, so I feel you.
Yeah, it's fun. Like, you know, I had some excellent shellfish in Boston, so that was fun, but it's just such a grind, Woody.
Oh, I can't even relate because I've never done it, but I've seen what it does to guys, and guys like yourself and Ian McIntyre admire the hell out of you for being able to do it. Just shellfish? You didn't have the lobster rolls or what?
Oh, no, I consider lobster to be shellfish. Yeah, I had
No, I didn't know if you got the invite.
Oh, no, not to that. They have the, I like the, like, hot buttered style lobster rolls. Do you guys know about this in Boston? They do a hot buttered version as opposed to, like, the cold mayo version.
All right.
It's much, far preferable, in my opinion.
Ooh, that sounds good.
I'll keep an eye out. I do love lobster. Big lobster guy. Anyways, big performance from Thatcher Demko against the Capitals yesterday, Woodley. I mean, I was saying I'm kind of struggling to think of another game where you would look at it and say, oh, Thatcher Demko stole them that game. But I kind of think that one yesterday qualifies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need the numbers to tell you that, right? Like, we saw the quality of saves that were required. And the truth is, there hasn't been as much of that of late. There have been more tighter games lately than we saw earlier in the season. And some good signs there as well in terms of how he's managed those. And, you know, like, it hasn't been, I don't want to say, it hasn't been an easy season for him. But as they've gotten better defensively, it's been harder for him to sort of, he is not required to stand out as much. So you look for those moments where, hey, where maybe they're off and they need the goalie to bail them out, or even just tight games, right? Like, not making mistakes in tight games. I've talked a lot about how, you know, we've seen this sort of narrative and betting market shift towards Connor Hellebuyck for the Vezina over the last 6 to 8 weeks. And a lot of that talk is, you know, his numbers in one goal games, and they're absurd. Like, I think he's at like 16 goals saved above expected, and like 13 or 14 are with the Jets just up by a single goal. But in order to do that, your team has to be up by a single goal. And for a large stretch of the season, that just wasn't the case here in Vancouver. Big leads, early leads. We're seeing more of this tight style game, and to see him play as well as he does or has in recent examples, like, that all bodes well. Like, there's none of it's a playoff test till you get into the playoffs, but it's certainly, the hockey's starting to feel a little more playoff-like than what we've seen, you know, for long stretches earlier this season where they were just pretty much running everyone out of the building.
Well, and I think your point about, you know, the Canucks being up big so often is a good one. And also, you know, the defense has been so much better for most of this season that, you know, he hasn't had to make as many really highlight saves, I don't feel. But yesterday you saw, it was kind of a reminder, he still has those abilities in kind of desperation type situations or where he needs to improvise or whatever it is. He can still make those really, really impressive, athletic, incredible saves on a regular basis.
Yeah, and sort of where he makes them, like, the strengths of his game are in tight, right? Like,
yep.
So, and we, there's a lot of certain Aiden Hill in there, not stylistically, but in terms of strength statistically. And we've talked before about, like, every team gives up high danger chances. It's sort of where you give them up that often matters. And if you're going to, you know, if the ones you give up in Vancouver are going to be low slot line plays, so east-west plays across the middle of the ice below the hash marks, I like Thatcher Demko's chances. Like, his ability to go sort of post to post, sort of use the pads, the legs, the ability to stay over the knees, get there, have vertical coverage, or what Ian Clark calls hand in support above that pad, taking away vertical space. Like, all those elements in his game, you sort of check those boxes, like, yep, yep, yep. And then you look at the numbers and it's like, that if you're attacking him that way and that's all you're giving up in the Canucks, when you do give up high danger chances, I like your chances because that's the strength of his game.
Kevin, over the course of the last six games or so, Vancouver's only been at like 91.5 at 5-on-5 in terms of the save percentage. So we're seeing just a little bit of dip, but then we see Demko yesterday in Washington and it's probably just noise, especially over a small sample. Are you seeing anything puck management-wise, anything out front that sort of corresponds to just a minor dip, like the Canucks goaltending tandem going to a level that's more good than great over the last, 3 weeks?
Well, I mean, if you look at Demko's season on a whole, and we've talked about this, from the get-go, really, like that incredible start where he led the league in adjusted save percentage and goals saved above expected and all those metrics. Like right now, he's at +1.6 in adjusted save percentage, and that's 10th, right? So still slightly better than Connor Hellebuyck, who everyone's got surpassing him for the Vezina, but nowhere near the stratosphere that we saw early. But also sort of not even where he was two seasons ago, which was around +2%. So, certainly no longer at sort of lead the league type performances. Jacob Markstrom's taken over on a cumulative basis in terms of goals saved above expected and, is almost double from a save percentage. So, this is kind of leveled off. And I think part of that is, the types of chances that they're giving up, like, you almost require perfection to still continue building against it because you're not getting like the Philly game early in the season where I think he was like five goals. Yeah. He gave up two, they lost 2-0, and he was like five better than expected. Like they're not having those types of nights as often. There's been consistency there. I just don't know that we've seen the high level from either guy. And, Casey DeSmith, who has been a great story and done a lot of good things for this team, like he's below expected at this point from a save percentage standpoint on the season. Like that's dipped over the last little while. So combine the two of them like that, and it's not where it was. And yet, like you said, we see signs the other night where it's certainly capable. We know it's still there. And you don't so much stress about it in terms of Demko having the ability to get back to that level when you need it.
And in terms of Vancouver's defensive play, I mean, just like the raw underlying numbers, so not the, like human adjusted clear sight numbers that you tend to cite, but just the raw underlyings suggest that this team's really leveled up defensively over the past 5 weeks. Is that consistent with what you're seeing just in terms of your eye test, but also in terms of the CSA data?
Well, there was that dip we talked about,
puck management
around
dip.
When the Lotto line was together where they started giving stuff off the rush. But in the last, 4 or 5 weeks, that's really tightened up. They're back to second in the league overall in the season in terms of what they give up high danger off the rush, and that's a really good place to be. Top five teams, still fifth overall, 5-on-5 expected goals against. Like, it's interesting, Thomas, because I think we all see those moments where mistakes are made, whether it's going to the wrong guy or, there's a bad turnover or it's even effort level at times where it just isn't quite the intensity, especially on the, tracking back through the neutral zone that leads to chances we hadn't seen as much. And they stand out and you think things have loosened up and yet on a whole, not that much, right? So I think what you're seeing is just, it's really hard to sort of maintain the level they set early in the season over the course of a season. Like there's going to be these dips, whether it's mental focus or straight out fatigue. Tomorrow night, let's see what they look like towards the tail end of this road trip. We saw it the last time they went on the road for a long time where they sort of that we've got to finish this strong mentality and everyone buying in and having a great game coming off at the end of that road trip. Can they do that again? Can they get that focus back? Can they all sort of rise to that occasion? It gets harder and harder to do as the season goes on. And that the messaging about the importance of it, it sort of bounces off you a little bit more as the year goes on and as it starts to grind on you a little bit. So I think there's been dips here and there, but the overall form underlying hasn't changed much. It's still positive.
How much do you think Carson Soucy's impact or absence, I should say, impacts things? Because I know, you know, maybe he doesn't always stand out on a shift-to-shift basis, but he was out of the lineup earlier in the season. It pretty much coincided with when they had that 500 stretch. He's out of the lineup right now. I feel like maybe we're underrating how important he can be for this team.
Well, I think in terms of preventing rush chances, the way he defends the rush and the penalty kill, and I know that's awkward to say or odd to say, you know, coming up a weekend where they kill off a 5-minute and like the penalty kill is trending up overall, but not again on the underlying, not to the degree it was when Carson Soucy was healthy. And you started to see it really tick up right before he got injured. So there's no question. You know, those are sort of considered the strengths of his game. I think the eye test shows you the way he uses the stick and the way he defends the front of the net. The stick off the rush in the front of the net on the PK and the way he sort of gets sticks in lanes on laterals on the PK. Like all those things we see are reflected in the underlying numbers. And when he's gone, it's not as good. Now the other guys have stepped up, but again, like the things they got him for when he's been healthy and in this lineup, especially sort of gotten his feet under him and been in there for a little bit, they've all looked better on paper when he's there and slipped a little bit when he's not.
Kevin, what do you make of just Vancouver's form post All-Star break? Seems like there's a little bit more frustration in the market, but what are you seeing in the team's game? Do you think that frustration from fans is warranted?
I mean, it's like comparing Demko now to Demko in the first 6 weeks of the season when he was historically great, right? Like, expectations change a lot of things, and the expectations, and they want this, though, right? Like, that's not a complaint. What have we heard, right? Like, they want to raise the bar. Well, if you're going to continuously talk about raising the bar and not taking step back and making these your habits, your staples, as opposed to something you're still trying to find, then that requires consistency. And so, I mean, I just think it's human nature, Thomas, to sort of have little letdowns here and there. I think right now you're looking at a team that's trying to figure out the top six mix. Do my eyebrows get raised when Elias Lindholm moves up to center the first line, just because we know how much pride a JT Miller takes in being that center and playing that position? I'm kind of curious to see how that goes. But I think you've got to give this time. Like, they just added what they hope is a key piece. It's certainly a piece that totally changes the mix of their top two lines. And it's going to take some time to sort it out. Like, for all the versatility that Lindholm brings, and as much as that's a positive, you still have to figure out how that piece fits. And that's why it's good they did it early, because it's pretty clear they're still trying to figure that out. And that fit for Lindholm, too, it's not just on the ice. It's, you know, where you're going to play him and what that does to other mindsets around the team, right? Like, so I'm kind of really curious to see how this goes and how long they stick with it as is. I was a little surprised at how quickly they abandoned it with Pettersson, as bad as it looked at times against Detroit. So, you know, again, there's time, there's no worries, but you're almost in an experiment phase. And anytime you're experimenting, then, you know, you're taking risks. You're not just going with the safe, I know this works. You're trying to find other things. And, you know, there might be some misses as well as hits in there. That's all part of sort of making sure you have not just the best mix by the time you get to the postseason, but different options that are comfortable playing with each other in case, whether through injuries or matchups, you need to switch it up from whatever ideal you arrive at the end of the season. It doesn't mean it's still going to be your ideal four games into the playoffs. And having guys comfortable in different roles and playing different with different guys has the potential to become very important come playoffs. And so as you sort of tinker with that, I think we are going to see a little more. You combine that with the time of the season and the amount of energy expended to sort of get to this level and try to maintain this level and how hard that is both, you know, mentally and habit-wise. Like, human nature is human nature. I just think you're probably going to see some ups and downs at this time of the season. And yet, as you talked earlier about the model, they're still favored to win the division. So, yeah. Like, where it becomes important and where you sort of walk that fine line between experimenting and sort of playing your best is if that comes into jeopardy. because I don't think you want any part of the 2-3 in the Pacific Division.
No, absolutely not. You want that to be Edmonton and Vegas. And, you know, your point about trying things out, that's one of the other factors with Lindholm's versatility. I mean, obviously, it's a great thing to have a versatile player like that, but it also gives you so many different options to work out and to experiment with, right? It's not as if there's one clear spot in the lineup and that's the only place he can go. So I think it will be a process of trying those things out and seeing which ones work the best for you. Now, part of that top six shuffle and trying different things out, Nils Höglander gets a chance to play with Elias Pettersson in the top six this weekend, scores twice, including a beautiful finish against the Capitals yesterday. We've seen Höglander play in the top six at other points this year, at one point alongside Miller and Besser, then get dropped back down further down the lineup. How much of a leash do you think he's earned in the coaching staff's eye to run with this opportunity this time in the top six?
Well, probably a longer leash, just given, you know, how other options haven't worked there, right? And I think of Mikheyev, right? Like, it's just not happening for him when he's up there. And so, but that also is going to depend on what you're looking for in terms, you know, like, as soon as he slips or starts to make any regular mistakes defensively or doesn't bring the same intensity to a top six role that he did to a bottom six, you know, if the offense dries up at all, then, and you're the coach and you're choosing, well, okay, I've got a guy who isn't scoring now either, but I don't trust him as much defensively as I do Mikheyev, who, yeah, no, okay, he's not scoring, but I know what I get defensively, and I trust he'll be in the right position on the wall, and he'll be on the right side of the puck, and, you know, he's not going to make those mistakes. That's where the leash gets short, right? So as long as you're scoring, it stays a little longer, and as long as you're doing all the other things. If you stop doing the other things, I think a lot of coaches might leave you out there as long as the scoring continues. But I'm not so sure with Rick Tocchet, because those are the, right, those are the staples we talked about. Those are the non-negotiables that he wants out there. And so he's even talked about this, about not wanting to elevate him prematurely because he likes the way he works in the other role. So as long as he keeps working that way, and it's both work rate and it's positionally and defensively and being in the right spot and not taking penalties like he did in Detroit, that sort of, you know, quietly was part of that comeback story for the Red Wings. Those are the types of things that he has to sort of continue to stay to have the opportunity. As much as we'll focus on scoring with this coach, I think it's the other things that matter just as much, if not more, at times.
With Höglander sort of performing the way he has and Mikheyev dropped down the lineup, I mean, we all know the production hasn't been there, but what are you seeing from him in terms of perhaps why he's struggled to this extent?
Have we seen the step yet?
No, I don't think so.
Right? Like, I mean, I feel like I haven't. I feel like I've almost forgotten what that looks like. And you think of the guy they signed, like how much of the offense that he was a part of. Like, I remember coming to Toronto, everyone talking to people that covered him there. It's like, oh man, he creates so much with his speed, but you know, the finishing isn't there, right? So he needs to create a ton in order to finish some, because he's never going to be an elite finisher. Well, now he's not creating a ton. Most of it's off cycle and sort of forecheck chances. It's not like he's not getting set up to like beat guys, like, because he's not. He's not beating guys wide. He's not getting passes through the neutral zone with speed that allow him to challenge guys to the outside, to take pucks to the net, to create the type of scoring chances that he used to create, you know, regularly in Toronto, to the point where, you know, what they lamented there was that he couldn't finish the number of breakaways he had. When was the last time we saw Ilya Mikheyev in a lull? And maybe I'm forgetting an instance here or there, but
you're right.
I haven't seen that stat. And listen, part of that's structural too. Like the way we don't see a ton of Canucks breakaways. Like they don't generate much off the rush.
Mm.
But that was one part of his game that I think, and maybe it's not fair. Well, certainly it's not fair in terms of coming off the ACL, but like maybe having that as an expectation, given how, you know, where the Canucks' focus is in terms of right side of the puck and not cheating for those types of chances, maybe that's not fair as well. But it's certainly something that stands out when we think of what Ilya Mikheyev was arriving to this team and what we see now. Those two things are totally different. And in the cycle game, you know, I mean, chances off the grind down low, like he might muck one in every once in a while, but in terms of, like, you know, hitting him into the slot with for a chance for a quick shot. Like, that finish has never really been a strength, and I haven't seen any sign of that suddenly turning around, you know, this far into his career where all of a sudden he's going to be a one-shot scorer. So without the speed element, you know, what do you have left offensively? And I think the answer to this point has been, you know, fairly not a ton.
Just before we let you go, Kevin, we haven't had a chance to chat with you since international hockey officially coming back best on best with the Four Nations tournament and then the NHLers going to the Olympics. Now, it's become very fashionable here on this side of the border to fret and worry about what's going on between the pipes for Team Canada. How much should Aiden Hill and his season, though, tamper some or put limit some of that fretting that Canadian hockey fans are doing?
Fashionable.
That well, listen, true.
Like adjusted save percentage wise, he leads the league right now. Right, he's the only guy ahead of Markstrom, and he did it in the playoffs last year. Like led the playoffs. I talked about it. You know, as much as the focus was this great defensive team, they still give up high danger. They just happen to give them up where he's really good at preventing them from going in. And the numbers he produced in the Stanley Cup playoff run, I said it at the time, project those out over an entire season, you've got a Vezina trophy. And guess what? He's slightly better this year. The problem is, it's like this guy's held together by duct tape and bailing wire. Like, and that's where I think, you know, on the international side, if he's an option, great. But the chances of him being an option, like you, it's fair to say, I'm not sure, right? Like, is he going to be an option? So we've seen enough of it. Like, he wasn't not the choice for Vegas at the start of the playoffs last year because, you know, because they saw other guys as better options. He wasn't healthy. And you look at the amount of time he's missed even since he's been there, right? So that's a fair question. Beyond that, you know, just for debate purposes, give me Jordan Binnington so we can have a giant fight over it. The fight he always wants but never gets.
Yeah, he'll be leading the fight, yeah.
Exactly. You know, like Connor Ingram, Tristan Jarry, Stuart Skinner behind a really great defensive effort in Edmonton since the coaching change. Like, there's options here. For sure.
I like Jarry.
Yeah, but amongst those options, there's also a very fair question that needs to be asked. Like, why are there so many better options in the States?
Yeah.
You know, why are there so many? And I don't even want to say so many, because if you look at Finland and Sweden, like, it thins out after the top two or three in both cases. Right? Like, what's Finland after UC Saros? Is it Jonas Korpisalo? And how's his season going, right? So the questions exist everywhere. But
this
I think
is Kevin Lankin in erasure, by the way.
My apologies, because I've been a big someone should get Kevin Lankin in at
Me
the
too.
Trade deadline guy.
This is also, and Kaapo Kähkönen, all my favorite deadline targets, Woody.
Kähkönen's actually having a, like, he's people sick. Don't realize how good he's been underlying numbers-wise.
He's so good.
But I guess the point is we expect more in Canada.
Yeah.
And it's fair because we have great goalies and great goalie coaches. You know what we don't have that the Americans have? We don't have a national development program for goaltending. You know that there is nobody at Hockey Canada right now employed to run goaltending? Not a single cent dedicated to a dedicated position or a dedicated program. Like, they don't even have anybody. They just randomly pull guys out. Not randomly. They're good coaches. They get pulled out for, like, to help pick teams for juniors. But that used to at least be a full-time position. Do you know I have Canadian goalie coaches that seek out and take the American certification program ahead of the Canadian one because it's run that much better. So listen, I don't think, like, there's no options. This is woe is me. We're in real trouble. But I think this is a question that should have been asked for years. I think it's a decade since Canada said they were coming up with a national goalie coaching certification program. They have one. Try and find a place to take it half the time. You can't. So there are definitely some reasons this has happened and some questions that I think it's fair to ask, but we're probably going to need another hour show for that.
Yeah, we'll do it. Maybe sometime closer to when the tournaments are getting going. Cause
you guys got me too fired up.
I was going to say that was everything I could have asked for and more from an answer. I love that, Woodley. So thanks for helping us out with that. And we'll chat again soon.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George and White Rock or WhiteRockHyundai.com. I did love that. Woodley was getting, like, legitimately incensed about it. That was awesome.
Classic goalie guy, always got to boost the number two.
We'll just ignore that. All right, we got an open hour to finish off the show here coming up. So text in 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll get some insights from Drancer. Got a chance to view a couple of Canucks prospects on this recent road trip, so we'll talk about that.
And Macklin Celebrini. I'm very serious. I think Bedard fatigue has caused us to actually underhype Macklin Celebrini as the number one overall. Blown away by my first live viewing.
We'll get the report on that. Take some of your texts as well. It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650.
Hitting the most important topics for Vancouver sports fans. The People Show with Vic Nizar. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
To Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650. Is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Lots to get into here. Again, as I said, open segment. We can return to some of the things that Elliot Friedman had to say on Donnie and Dolly earlier today, but we can take some texts as well, so keep texting in. As mentioned, you were on the road covering the Canucks for part of this road trip. You did a little bit of extra time in Boston, got a chance to go check out Boston University hockey team, which of course features Canucks first round draft pick Tom Vilander, another Canucks draft pick Aiden Celebrini, and Aiden's brother, presumptive first overall pick in this upcoming NHL draft, Macklin Celebrini as well.
So let's start with Macklin Celebrini, because Vancouver born, right? Father Rick Celebrini, of course, Vancouver 86ers player back in the day, and then was still the team doctor for working with the Whitecaps, but was involved with the Canucks for a period of time, and now heads up and you know, they've got one of those like human recovery and performance department names, but the Golden State Warriors. So, you know, he spent sort of his teenage years in North California, but really is like a Vancouver trained player. Actually was North Shore Winter Club on the ice with Kent Johnson and Connor Bedard at some like star-studded open ice sessions back in the day. I think because of Bedard fatigue, like Bedard was such a generational prospect and soaked up so much oxygen that we really spent a lot of time focused on it. And it feels like there's less hype around Macklin Celebrini. And I feel like it's a cyclical fatigue thing. You know, it's like, how much are we going to spend a bunch of time blowing up the presumptive number one?
Well, if there's a generational pick, you almost have to leave space after it, because it's like, well, we have to we have to acknowledge that was a generational guy, so the next guy almost has to be lesser. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's just, otherwise it doesn't make sense.
Right.
Even though that's not actually true, you can have Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews went in back-to-back drafts, first overall.
Right.
Right? Like, you can have two incredible top-of-the-league type players in back-to-back drafts.
And there was less buzz on Matthews.
Yes.
Right?
100%.
But that was also a product of him playing in Switzerland, kind of like out of sight, out of mind, in his final season prior to draft eligibility. So I think it was a little different, in that there was an additional structural dynamic that's kind of absent with Macklin Celebrini. But like, what this guy's doing is on par with Jack Eichel's NCAA Div 1 year, right? Like, this is on par, if not eclipsing, what Adam Fantilli did.
Mm.
And we were talking about Fantilli as like number one in any other year. Well, you know what? He wouldn't be number one in this year, right? Like, very seriously, would not. Macklin Celebrini's only 17, and he doesn't turn 18 till June, and he's playing Div 1 hockey at a well north of point per game pace.
Oh, yeah, like closer to 2 points per game than point per game.
The way Boston University plays, you know, seeing them live against Merrimack, not exactly the most robust competition, although it's worth noting that 4 days before I saw him play, he like crushed Boston College at the Beanpot at TD Bank North Garden, right? Like big stage, mm-hmm. full arena, destroyed, personally destroyed, picked his teeth with Boston College. Every shift out, he was skating through or could skate through the entire team. He was like manufacturing scoring chances at absolute will. He has the sort of one-time bomb that will make him a day one flanker on an NHL power play and probably a productive one. But what, and I kind of knew that, and I knew the defensive reliability stuff. Like I knew that he was a super conscientious two-way player, precocious for his age, given that. What I didn't know was the puck and body control in combination with the speed. Where it's like, you know, I'm not going to drop like a Jack Hughes comp because he's not Jack Hughes, but that style of ability to skate with the puck and create in transition, I didn't realize he was that dynamic in transition. Seeing him, I was honestly blown away, and I don't think we're hyping this guy up enough. Like, this guy's going to be the second consecutive Vancouver-born number one overall pick, and he's going to be a day one impact player. Like, no question in my mind, this guy's a day one impact player in the NHL.
All right. Let's get hyped.
He is sick, man.
And as Corey the Carpenter texts in, watch Chicago get the first round pick again and have those two studs for the next 20 years. We'll see. They've got competition at the bottom of the standings for sure.
And no one wants that.
No, absolutely nobody wants that.
Tom Volander. He's just not controlling games, right? Like they tried to play him with Lane Hutson. BU did, mm-hmm. and like very seriously, the way BU plays, like it's one game when you've got Lane Hutson and Macklin Celebrini, who both have like chemistry, like there's some chemistry there between those two, and the game totally changes when those two are on the ice. They tried really hard. Volander played a lot with Lane Hutson for months, but when I saw him, he was back on the second pair. It's a little bit of a different role, a little bit of a different calibration. You know, I do think he's trying to play differently. And I think what we're sort of seeing with Volander over the course of this D1 season, his rookie campaign in North American collegiate hockey, is, you know, not too dissimilar from what we saw at the World Juniors. Like, I think this is a defensive first guy in terms of his mindset. Like, his speed is excellent. He made some great defensive plays, great defensive reads, but he's really conscious, I think, of playing like a clean, simple game.
Mm.
And as a result, you know, there's not moments where he's like taking over, you know, or like really dictating tempo with the puck the way that, you know, certainly you'd hope to see a player begin to do over the course, like escalating over the course of their first year in Div 1 hockey as an 18-year-old, right? Like that's... And perhaps it'll come. I know the club itself is hoping to see more offensive growth from him. I think it's a reason why he's probably not going to be signed after the season, why he's going to spend a second year at BU. You know, I think the club wants to see him take on a larger offensive role. Something a little more similar to what they saw at the U18s. You know, he's playing PP2. He was playing PK2. He was playing like second pair minutes. I'd say he was kind of their four in terms of usage. It's definitely not been like he hasn't popped. I'd say it's fair to say his D+1 season, he hasn't popped. But the toolkit, the intelligence, the defensive play, that stuff's all there. That like extra bit of dynamism, you know, that like McAvoy, Werenski
sure.
level of like, and I'm just specifically picking NCAA first rounders, like. Guy, you know, that ability to dictate play and sort of contribute offensively and off the rush and key those sorts of things, that's not his game at this point. And you know, that matches sort of what I was saying after we saw him at Dev Camp, right? Like, I think there's a little bit more project on him in terms of you can see the tools, but I think it's going to be a little bit of a learning curve as his, you know, technique in terms of puck control and ability to think and read the game offensively and really assert himself in that area develops.
Yeah, and I mean, I will see where his offensive game goes, because I think even after the draft, like pre-dev camp, this was a pick with the thought that there's going to be a baseline of defensive impact that his skill set allows him to have. And then the offense, as you said, maybe a bit more of a project or a bit more of a question mark. And, you know, you're always going to want to see that element of someone's game at a lower level, because typically even the guys that go on to be more defensive oriented, they tend to have those big offensive impacts in junior, in the NCAA, wherever it might be. But it's going to be, it's a it's an interesting player type to track their development, right? Where you know you're not necessarily counting on that high-end offensive impact, certainly at the NHL level, but you still want to see those signs of growth and that progress as he continues to play.
Yeah, and I mean, he's hitting a baseline level of production, 14 points in 25 games, where, you know, now that's a very high-scoring team, right? Like, oftentimes you send a short outlet to the neutral zone and Macklin Celebrini
yep.
is going to skate through guys and do something, right? But he's hitting at least like a baseline level of production. Let me give you an example, because he's a Vancouver Canuck now, but we don't always think of him as like a high pedigree defenseman. Ian Cole, okay, was drafted 18th overall in 07 and went to Notre Dame. 20 points in 43 games. You know, like that's kind of... Sometimes if you draft a first-round defenseman, you might get a player as opposed to a star, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you might get a guy who's going to play, you know, no one would look at Ian Cole selected 18th
overall. Just played his 800th game.
Just played his 800th career game.
One Stanley Cup. You know, part a ton of winning teams, all of that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's a good pick. You know, like, that's a good pick. But that's kind of, at least he's hitting that baseline level where, hey, you know, there's a lot of... At least he's keep hitting a baseline level of production where there's an NHL ceiling there.
Yeah.
And there's no question in my mind that this guy's going to play games given the physical attributes, given the skating, given the ability to read the game defensively. It's just that next level that, you know, I think he'll need to show progress on before the Canucks are eager to get him into the system and have him turn pro.
It's an interesting comp, actually, Ian Cole, right? That style of game where you play a long time. And, you know, Ian Cole has puck skills, right? There's a reason he was that first round pick.
For sure.
He's never been like a dynamic offensive player, but those puck skills help him be super reliable, stay in the lineup forever, you know, contribute to winning teams.
He's like patient with the puck.
Yeah.
You know, he's like an effective puck mover. He's not a dynamic puck mover. He's an effective puck mover, right? Yeah, I mean, new NHL right-handed Ian Cole is kind of like a floor case for Vilander. Appeals to me.
Yes.
Like, I find that an appealing comp.
Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of value, as you said there, to be had from a player like that. Anything on Aiden Celebrini?
I was impressed. I really liked Aiden Celebrini's game overall, to be totally honest with you. Big body, right-handed, smart. You know, again, this is a guy drafted in the sixth round.
Yep.
So, and a freshman at BU. You know, he's playing third pair, but he plays a little bit more than that. Like, you know, I'd say he's a five guy. They don't track ice time, but like, you know, my impression was that he was out there pretty regularly. Not on the power play, getting a little bit of PK work here and there, but not a fixture on that. You know, I think his role will grow. I just think he's a smart player. Like, there's some... I think there's some penchant to, like, freelance. Like, he needs to rein it in a little bit in terms of some of that stuff. But his defensive reliability, like, his ability to turn pucks over, get the puck moving the other direction, like, I don't know, man. Again, absolute project, given where he was drafted.
Of course.
No one's surprised by that. But there's something there. That's a sharp player. Like, you could see that there's a lot of intelligence and an NHL frame. Like, he's a big guy.
Yeah, he's not undersized by any stretch. And that's another player, interesting, as you said, you know, drafted in the sixth round out of the AJHL, the Brooks Bandits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, always something when you're, especially even as a defenseman, when you don't have really eye-popping numbers from the junior A level, there's always a bit of, okay, where's this going? So to hear the report and see, you know, an adjustment as a freshman to the NCAA, big, big jump up in terms of the level of play, obviously, from junior A in Alberta there. So that's positive signs from Aiden Celebrini in his first year at Boston University. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And I wanted to read this text. Chet and Burnaby sent it in a little bit earlier, said, I was amused the talk this morning was all about the Washington game. Nobody even mentioned Zadorov's suspension. That's from Chet in Burnaby. And yeah, I mean, we had a draft of headlines from the weekend, and we didn't really mention the fact that Nikita Zadorov was suspended for two games. And, you know, you had the you and Harmon had the stock report, the stock watch on the Canucks kind of post All-Star break. Whose game is trending up? Whose game is trending down? Zadorov was in the trending down section. And I do think one of the reasons that his suspension, his absence, which will continue tomorrow, hasn't generated more discussion. One, it was a very news-heavy weekend, right? So there's a lot of other things to talk about. But also, we'd already seen his usage start to come down. And importantly, Noah Juulsen play really, really well, and his usage tick up here, right? So not that it's not a big deal to lose Nikita Zadorov for a couple of games, but I think we kind of already have seen what Noah Juulsen is providing make it less concerning. Now, you still look, they acquired Zadorov. They obviously, the physical tools, the physicality, all of that, you want his game to round back into form. But I do think it's interesting how kind of linked those two are, right? The fact that Juulsen's game is up makes it a little easier to stomach, or kind of pushes it off the radar that Nikita Zadorov out of the lineup, and before that, his minutes were trending down.
Yeah, I mean, the Zadorov's minutes really spiked across his first 5 weeks with the Canucks, and then sort of beginning January 8th, which coincides with the return of Carson Soucy, you've seen a steady decline, you know, to the point where really his minutes and Noah Juulsen's have kind of met, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been partnered together of late before Zadorov's suspension. By the way, what did you think of the suspension? I thought it was a borderline hit.
I thought it was fine, the suspension.
Yeah, I didn't like strongly disagree, but I wouldn't have been shocked if it had just been a fine, especially
yeah,
after
fine,
he got the
game,
match penalty,
something like that. Yeah, with the match penalty,
you know, like I don't know, it looked like a tough one, you know, like it looked like a difficult one to evaluate for me. I couldn't my reaction to it at first blush wasn't like, oh my god, terrible hit, you know what I mean? Like, it felt unfortunate more than it did malicious.
Yeah,
so I was kind of surprised that it was a two gamer anyway. But, yeah, I mean, over the last 10 games, 7 of which Juulsen's played, 9 of which Zadorov's played, the ice time gap between them is about 15 seconds. You know, 5-on-5, Zadorov was at like 16, 17 minutes for the first month and mm-hmm. a half of his Canucks career. And now, like, over the last 10 games, he's at like 14 minutes per game. You know, if you factor in the Detroit game where he gets, you know, kicked off halfway through, it's like 12.8 minutes a game. Like, that's like a very steep curve downward.
Yep.
And that, to me, especially given that we've seen him get benched, right, for a mistake, like, feels a little telling. You know, like, I just think this coaching staff at the moment anyway trusts Ian Cole more. And when Soucy, and when Soucy gets back, I think there's going to be a discussion, Zadorov or Juulsen.
Well, I was going to say, like, if it's game one of the playoffs tomorrow and they're fully healthy and Soucy is ready to go, is Zadorov one of the 6 defensemen in the lineup? Or because of how far Noah Juulsen's game has come and the fact that he's a right shot, the fact that he's so effective on the penalty kill and that he's really vastly improved the other areas of his game from the beginning of the year, like, I don't think it's clear cut that Zadorov is in the lineup necessary. Because it's really only him or Juulsen. He's not in over Cole. He's not in over Soucy. He's not in over Myers. And obviously Hughes and Hronek. So it's, can he get in over Nikita Zadorov? And I think it's like, if you flipped the handedness of the players, then I think the answer is yes, pretty much undoubtedly. But the priority of having the 3 right shot guys in the lineup and the 3 left shot, I think that might give Juulsen the edge right now. Now, look, there's 29 games to play here, so Zadorov's going to come back. He'll get back in. Carson Soucy's still injured. He has a chance to change that and you know, pull ahead of Noah Juulsen again. But right now, like, I kind of think it would be Juulsen if it was game one of the playoffs tomorrow.
I would not be surprised, especially given how crucial he's been to the PK, right? Like, of late, Juulsen's averaging like 2.5 minutes a game on the PK.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's...
And the PK is in a bright spot right now.
Yeah, he's become an essential part of this team's game 4-on-5. I think that's hard to take out of your lineup, especially given this club's historic vulnerability in that phase of the game.
Look how much that's kept Nils Åman in the lineup for a long time, right? 100%. Like, Sam Lafferty comes out instead of him because you know you need that solidity on the penalty kill.
I want to talk about the Lucas Raymond goal really quickly, though.
Sure.
Right? Because Myers, obviously, a tough moment for him. We haven't seen many. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But Myers' ice time spiking again, right? So for the last five weeks, Myers' ice time's, you know, up closer to 17 and a half minutes a game, 5-on-5, just 5-on-5.
Mm-hmm.
Clear number 3 in the pecking order. You get Myers into those minutes, you know, I do think that's where you there's like a sweet spot, you know, and if you overheat his role too much, I think you're going to bump into some of the problems we've seen in the past few years where you're asking him to do too much, as opposed to the contained game that we've seen and that the Canucks have been able to extract from him this season, where he's been like, no question, a huge net positive. Right. I just want to note this like in advance, because as I saw that Raymond goal, I just thought to myself, like, you know, at some point, I do worry a little bit that this club's amping up. He's like, you know, it's a vicious cycle. He's like, he settled his game down in a smaller role. He performed so well.
So we start to rely on him.
Yep. You know, and I just worry that like Lady Fortuna eventually turns her wheel when it comes to, you know, like really good fourth defensemen who occasionally get used as a 2-3.
Yep.
Right? Like that's, it's a tough gig, man. It's a tough gig. And I just worry that, you know, if they amp up Myers' role too much, do we see some of the things that have frustrated Canucks fans and frankly, this coaching staff too in the past?
Well, we're having this conversation, right? Zadorov's usage ticking down. Would he be in the lineup if it was game one of the playoffs? We're talking about them leaning on Tyler Myers a little too much. And look, part of this is when Carson Soucy comes back, does he kind of slide into that number three role in terms of ice time and usage? And sure, he does, but he's also a left shot, so that's still a lot of right shot minutes to soak up. And look, I'm coming to an inescapable conclusion here, Dranser, which is that the Zadorov out, Tanev in makes a ton of sense. Like, it solves both of those problems, right? Because then Tanev slots above Tyler Myers in the pecking order. All of a sudden, you have Tyler Myers in that third slot where you love what he's able to give you and his minutes are contained. You know, you bring Carson Soucy back, he's down to like fifth in terms of where he is in your pecking order. Look, The report from Elliot Friedman, it's matching a lot of what he's had to say and what we've heard on Chris Tanev. This was from earlier today on Donnie and Dolly. Teams are offering seconds for Tanev. Calgary wants to see if someone gets that up to a first, and also kind of saying, I'm not sure the Canucks can afford to do it, especially if it goes to a first round pick level, but maybe even if it stays at that kind of second round plus.
If the Canucks were willing to do it for a first,
it would be done. Yeah. But having said that, you also think about how aggressive Jim Rutherford likes to be. You know, what else Elliot Friedman was having to say, which is he's never going to stop trying. He's always going to be looking for those ways to improve his team. And I also just think, like, you look at the how many times this team has done the salary out before as a prelude to bringing in another player, right? Even if it's a player they acquired. You go back to Jim Rutherford in Pittsburgh, where he brought in Tanner Pearson, then later that season traded him to the Canucks for Eric Goodbranson. It's obviously the type of thing he's willing to do. And look, maybe the price ends up being prohibitive. Maybe there is a team out there that wants to go to the first round pick level and it takes the Canucks out of the bidding. But just, there is a ton of logic. Like, it's not, I think when the Tanev thing came up, some people kind of looked at it as, oh, you know, we're just saying that because he's a former Canuck and there's the emotional connection. But I think the farther we go into the season and you look at how they're using Zadorov, how the rest of their blue line shapes up, like, the logic just keeps getting more and more compelling to me that if there's any avenue, and I admit that it would be very, very complicated, but if there is any avenue towards bringing Chris Tanev back, like, it's not just an emotional thing. It's not just a nostalgia thing. There's a tremendous hockey case to be made right now for the Canucks.
Another right-handed body would be big, especially if they were top
like
four quality.
The difference of Tyler Myers as your second right-shot guy as your third is massive. Like, well, that's a huge, huge difference.
Well, and this just brings us back to the Phil Kessel thing where, you know, on the one hand, he's free, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no acquisition cost aside from a contract slot and whatever cap dollars he represents. But given that he's, you know, profiles is like an offensive add to the bottom six, and offense from the bottom six is one of
the least of their concerns.
Is literally the strength of this team aside from goaltending.
Yeah.
You know, I think we have to sort of almost recalibrate how we're thinking about it, right? The opportunity cost of every dollar of cap committed, right? Of every contract, one-way contract especially, that you add to the books between now and the deadline is mammoth. Like, it's actually really high because, you know, that $1 million and spot on the roster could be another big penalty-killing forward, right? It could be another depth defenseman. It could be a top four defenseman. It could be,
yep,
you know, the Kakkonen, Kevin Lankinen tier guy who comes in because you get an injury in net, and that becomes a really crucial piece to add. You know, like, that to me, those to me are really high leverage spots. A player like Kessel is not. And you have to think that way in discussing or thinking about Vancouver's options between now and March 8th at this point of the season.
We will take a break. Keep your texts coming in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final show or final show. Whoa, that would be something. Final segment of the show coming up here.
Something you don't know that I do.
I've said too much already. Final segment of the show coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. All right, welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Stranz. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650! 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. Our producer, Dom Shermati, has given us license to talk about the Super Bowl here, which we'll do, but I'll save it for the end of the show.
Yeah, maybe. Talk about the big game.
The big game, quote unquote.
We can do hockey takeaways from the big game.
I was going to say, I normally try to have like a Canucks-related take to non-hockey news, but I don't have one for the Super Bowl.
What does Kyle Shanahan's time management mean for the Elias Pettersson extension?
Okay. I mean, that one's interesting to me in terms of The advantage is called the second mover advantage.
Yes.
Right? If you really break it down and distill it to game theory, okay, there's this notion. I actually had a lot of thoughts about this last night.
I'm shocked by that.
Go off, King.
So the question you make with the NFL's new playoff overtime format.
Yep.
Okay, which guarantees that both teams possess the ball.
Yep.
And then there's a sudden death.
By the way, I got to say, I had no idea what was going to happen when the clock ran out. Until Tony Romo said, I was like, I have no idea. Is the game over? Do they start a new over? Like, what's happening?
The clock
doesn't
exist.
The clock is basically meaningless. Completely. Literally, all they would have done was switch sides.
Correct.
Yeah.
To quote Mean Girls, the limit does not exist.
But I was like, this is great. I have no idea what's going to happen when that clock hits zero.
This is great. I have no idea what's going on.
I'm on the edge of my seat here.
Fair.
Jamie's counting down like a New Year's.
No, I was like, this is, but it's like, how often is that? That's never been the case in a big game where you're like, there's a rule that's about to come in play, and I have zero idea what it could possibly mean. This is exciting.
So I've spent a lot of time reading and thinking about this prior to the playoffs. I've been obsessed with hoping that we get to see it.
Yeah.
It was just as good as I'd hoped. But the real interesting part is you have to make a decision when you win the coin flip in overtime. Do you want the information?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want the hammer of being able to eliminate the other team first, right?
If you get, it's either you get the information or you get the third possession.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
And the third possession is the sudden death possession. Now, my view is the second mover advantage is probably more powerful,
mm-hmm.
assuming that football teams are going to function like football teams, which is you're going to score a touchdown and you're going to kick for one, right? That's your best case scenario. The way I actually think the optimal way to approach it is to think about it this way. We need to score and hit a 2-point conversion.
Mm. If you get the ball first.
Yeah.
That's what you're looking to do.
I think because the way you can control the outcome, right, is to score a touchdown, get a 2-point conversion, and then worst case scenario, first of all, then you get to try and prevent a touchdown. Then you get another coin flip 50-50 shot, right? And then you get a chance to eliminate them with a field goal on the third possession. Or you fail at the 2-point conversion and you still get to try and stop them from kicking, from scoring a touchdown, but they can't kick a field goal to beat you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So that to me is the way to go. To give you the most control. But who would have thought that? Like, who would have really?
And I think the thing is also, this is like, people always talk, we had this discussion after the Dan Campbell stuff, right? Where people are always like, oh, it's all about the context of the game. That's obviously true once it becomes
it's all about the context of where you are and what came before you.
Sure. I don't know what that's a reference to.
I'll show you after.
Okay. Anyways, that becomes really most true when it's as close to a coin flip
really
as possible.
You really didn't see the coconut tree thing this weekend?
No, oh I did God. Not.
Okay, sorry.
Anyways, and I think in this case, like, first of all, so there's also the discussion about the fact that San Fran was maybe not entirely clear on the rules, right? So that's leaving that
well,
aside,
because of Kyle Juszczyk.
Yes, and other
but
guys.
Well, yeah, but the players don't have to be in charge.
Well, anyways, leave that aside. Leave that aside. They had just, their defense had just been on the field, right? And Casey had marched on them to tie the game. So I think in that context, that does ticket slightly to, hey, our defense is tired, let's go get the ball first, right? If you're, because I look at it as probably basically a coin flip. There are advantages on either side to either kicking first or getting the ball first in overtime. I think that if your defense is tired and you need to give them a rest, I think it makes it a very much understandable decision for San Francisco.
I think the only reason to take the ball first is if you are confident you can move the ball, score a touchdown, and your intention is to go for two. If you're not completely committed to playing that scenario out, you are better off to take the information.
Yeah, and look, Casey,
and there's no way Kyle Shanahan was thinking about it that way.
No,
so
he
made a mistake. So he made a mistake.
100% not. But Casey did say they would have kicked, right? So San Fran made their choice for
him. Oh, yeah, Andy Reid knew, of course.
And so, they had been, like, drilling it all week.
Anyway, one thing I do think about, though, is, like, optimal strategy, in my view, is what we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what you're doing in a game as a coach is adapting optimal strategy to the reality of your matchup and your players' fatigue levels and on and on. So, you know, if the... But it doesn't sound like the tired thing was the motivation and prioritized the hammer of the first...
That was his stated reasoning, right? We wanted the third possession.
Oh, and I believe him.
Yeah.
I believe him. And I just think he got it wrong. But that's the point. Like, it's not about Dan Campbell's fourth down conversions. Like, you know, those were 50-50s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to pick what works for your team. Pick what makes sense in the moment, given, like, how tired people are. How's the matchup going? Can we reliably move the ball? Are we getting, is our O-line getting destroyed? Stuff like that. And you see that in hockey all the time, too, right? Like, there might be an optimal strategy, but sometimes what matters most, talks about it all the time, is just, like, manage the game. Don't get killed here.
Yeah.
Limit the damage. If you make one mistake, that's going to happen. Don't make multiple mistakes that compound and then there's a backdoor tap in.
Yeah.
You know, I find that sort of the fascinating part is, like, that space between game theory, analytics, optimal strategy, and the need to adapt it to actual, like, human performance and sort of the ebbs and flows in that. The reliability of that in a league where you play all the time and have very difficult matchups against the best in the world.
Well, and there are so few decisions in hockey where... like that coin flip decision in the NFL, right? You know what I mean? Where it's like all on the coach, everything's frozen in time. It's almost purely mathematical in some ways, at least from the outside. Like that's such, it's so unique to football to have those moments.
Dom has the clip of the coconut tree. This is the current American vice president. And it's just such a funny clip.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you.
So good.
You haven't heard that?
No, I have not heard that. Now that you mentioned it, I've seen people referencing a coconut tree, but I have not heard the clip. So thank you for sharing that.
Sorry,
with me.
I needed you to understand. But
yes.
You're like, in the context of, I'm like, the coconut tree?
I was like, yeah.
Anyway. Sorry, it's going to take me a sec. Okay, here's another hockey takeaway from the Super Bowl. 2 years ago, the Kansas City Chiefs traded the single best wide receiver in football. The best, most gravity-altering weapon in the sport. And then proceeded to win two straight Super Bowls. Why and how? Well, they reinvested the picks and the money in defense, right? Their defense is still young and cheap, relatively speaking, but they prioritized spending assets on the defensive side of the ball and trusting that Mahomes could kind of just figure it out with lesser wide receivers. You know, they've placed like a high volume of bets on wide receivers. Some of them have worked, like Rashee Rice in the second round. More of them have not, like Sky Moore in the second round, or Kadarius Tony, or Justin Ross, or
et cetera.
Justin Watson, who I'm pretty sure is the Anthony Beauvillier of the NFL.
All right.
He had a good game yesterday. Anyway. Yep. But he gets a lot of cardio. The thing that then results is we've seen three KC championships. We've seen KC in the Super Bowl four times. And the first two times we saw them there, they were this like explosive downfield team with like Sammy Watkins and Tyreek Hill and Patrick Mahomes throwing the ball 12 yards, you know, 12 air yards of pass. And then what we saw yesterday, which was this like far more mature, far more controlled, far more plain and predictable, but nonetheless incredible version of the Chiefs where you rely on your defense. Patrick Mahomes game manages things, which is not a negative in this case. And you try and control the clock and win a totally different way with also ideally a good run game, although Pacheco was terrible last night. So, you know, if you're going to have sustained success, especially in leagues like the NFL and the NHL with a cap, although the NFL cap, I'm pretty sure, is mostly imaginary, from my understanding. Players just get, like, restructured all the time.
The New Orleans Saints agree with you.
Right. So, but nonetheless, there are still restrictions on your ability to pay personnel, soft as they might be in the NFL, yeah, relative to the NHL system.
But also, I mean, and in Kansas City's case, right, their GM has talked about, like, how long they started planning for what they knew was going to be a historic extension for Patrick Mahomes, and of course turned out to be right. And look, I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of how it's structured, because as you said, the NFL cap is extraordinarily complicated and there's all these loopholes and everything, but like the Tyreek Hill is part of it, right? It's like, okay, we're gonna pay Patrick Mahomes because he's Patrick Mahomes. That's gonna necessitate some really, really difficult choices elsewhere on the roster. That hasn't been perfect, those difficult choices, but they've done enough of it in kind of reorienting their team. And the two things that spring to mind for me is, like, one, pay the guy who's the guy, right? And in this case, it's Patrick Mahomes, and it's hard to draw any comparisons to anyone playing in hockey right now because, like, he's so otherworldly successful, right, that it's an easy, it's a no-brainer, and it's a quarterback and all that.
No individual, aside from a goalie, can really, yeah, and goalies don't have as much actual control As a quarterback does.
But I also think about, there's a very like popular narrative for decades in hockey, right, about team success. Like, think about the Steve Yzerman career arc as it's portrayed, right? Like, 150-point guy, you know, in the 80s, but then finally learned to be a two-way player, and he won Stanley Cups for the Red Wings. Or think about more recently, like the Tampa Bay Lightning, right? Oh, high-flying, record-setting regular season team, but then they really became this veteran, mature, more defensive team, and they won two Stanley Cups like that. The Washington Capitals. Right, like, you can find so many examples of it. It's more complicated in the Chiefs case, but I feel like this is like a better version of a better example than any of the hockey ones I made. Now, it's different because the Chiefs had won a Super Bowl, as you said, with Tyreek Hill and Sammy Watkins and everyone already, but like, they really did completely change their identity with the Tyreek Hill trade, and all of a sudden Patrick Mahomes, he still has those moments of individual brilliance, but he also plays within himself to an incredible degree, right? Avoids those mistakes, makes smart play after smart play. It's like, it in some ways, it does give credence to this idea of you almost have to undergo that transformation if you're going to be a championship caliber team.
See, but I don't think you necessarily have to undergo that transformation. It's just that they don't have the weapons to pull off anything else.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's a tactical retreat. You see what I'm
saying?
Because
of the salary cap.
A tactical retreat in part of the salary cap, and in part because they didn't nail their efforts to replace him. Like, they spent a lot of picks to get Kadarius Toney. He didn't even play. Right? What?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
They spent a second round pick on Sky Moore, who was hurt, but like also is dust.
Yeah.
Will never be anything. Sorry, Sky Moore.
MVS ran 10 yards backwards after a...
How dare you? MVS made me so much
after
money.
After a reception for some reason.
MVS is... How dare you? But yeah, no, I mean...
That one didn't make sense.
That was just like...
That was
one of the... There's been so many moments this year where you're like, imagine what Patrick Mahomes thinks about his wide receivers. Imagine, like, in his heart of hearts, what he thinks about these guys.
The coach's reactions, too. Where they were just like, just get down! Stop!
That second reception where he ran backwards... six. It's like a 4 yard gain that he turned into a 5 yard loss. Yes. Right. So he basically runs 10 yards backwards. That was the leg, like that was the reception I needed to pay off like a $600 same game parlay.
Of course,
so
it would be,
of course, because I had a completely like I'm the authorities might show up at my house at any moment. Same game parlay that required two Noah Gray receptions, two Juszczyk receptions, and two MVS receptions. Okay, just like the gnarliest SGP ever. And it hits, and so he's like running back, and I'm like, MVS, yeah, what a beauty. And everyone else at the Super Bowl party is like, what's he doing? What's he doing? I'm like, who cares? What a hero. It was very funny.
He almost dropped that touchdown reception.
No, he didn't.
MVS, yeah, he was fumbling it.
No.
Yeah.
That was such a sick play design. Anyway, I think the... So for me, the lesson's less the Yzerman thing, because you'll be shocked to learn this, but that's a hockey bromide that I'm convinced
is
a fiction.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think so too, but I guess
I think it's something nice that we say about players who are past their statistical prime.
You're like
post, but still on good teams.
You're post hoc crafting a narrative onto a player's career, right? But I do, like, I just find it interesting that they won these back-to-back Super Bowls by just like leaning into, we're going to be hyper responsible and like detail oriented and all defensively responsible, all of those things. Like, it's striking to me. Maybe I shouldn't say that it's necessary to undergo that transformation, but that like it's viable across sports to kind of do that tactical retreat and just find that baseline level of performance like the Chiefs have found.
Yeah, I think also it's like the great ones adapt.
Yes.
You know, the great ones adapt, but I also think the great organizations adapt around them.
Mm.
So in a competition where there's an efficiency component, by which I mean that there are restrictions on what you can spend on personnel, you have to make really difficult prioritization decisions. And the Chiefs' decision was effectively, we're going to prioritize defense and our O-line and spending on that, as opposed to spending on wide receivers. We're going to fill the gaps. Now, that sort of runs a little bit contrary to what we're seeing other teams do, right? Like, it wasn't just Tyreek, it was also Devontae Adams. Like, Chase is going to get paid in a major way. Jefferson's going to get, like, we're seeing significant expenditure at the wide receiver position. I don't think it's even misguided. These guys are hard to find. And it's not like a running back where you can plug a guy in. You know what I mean? Like, you plug MVS in and it's MVS. Like, we've seen this. So, but I do think teams need to reinvent themselves in these situations, or especially around, you know, whether in Mahomes' case, it would be a quarterback. But I think for a hockey team, like for the Canucks, it's going to be a core group.
Mm-hmm.
A core group you think can get it done. For Tampa Bay, it was a core group.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of have to tweak it at the margins.
Absolutely ruthless around it, though, is the thing. And because, you know, the Tyreek Hill trade is fascinating, because it also gives me a chance to get on another one of my hobby horses, right? Which is the idea that you can't trade a good player, right? Or like, you know, speculating or hypothesizing about trading a good player is ridiculous because they're good. Like, this happens all the time. Somebody will text in like, should they consider trading X? And people are like, no, they're a good player. It's like, Tyreek Hill's been like the most productive receiver in football over the last two seasons. Now, part of that is he goes to a perfect system, but they didn't trade him because he's a bad player. They weren't like, oh, Tyreek is holding us back on the field and we need to get rid of him so we can get better. They traded him because they knew they were going to get value. And as you said, it's an efficiency thing, right? Okay, he's really good. No one's questioning that. We need to get the picks back, and then we need to reallocate that money. And I think that is a very, very important lesson for fans, but also NHL teams, is sometimes you have to part with a good player. You cannot just look at it as, we're only going to trade bad players and we're just going to relentlessly hoard our good players, because you need to be able to make those really, really difficult decisions, even for a player as impactful, as dynamic, as good as Tyreek Hill.
Oh, and you need to be able to reinvent yourself and lean into different things that might work for you as an organization, right? So, you know, and actually, I think what we're seeing with the Canucks is this season is a really interesting example of that, because, you know, do you remember it was like the last days of Travis Green when he said it in Buffalo, they'd gotten crushed by Tage Thompson and company, and he said, we're not a run and gun team. And everyone was like, what? That's exactly what you are. And then Boudreaux came in, and this was like a more offensively calibrated team, but there was no structure to it. And we were talking, can this team do both? Right now, under Rick Tocchet, this is a defense-first team.
Yeah.
Period. Like, period. The staple element of this team's game. I know they've been at the top of the NHL leaderboard in terms of goals all season. Are they still? I'm not sure, but they definitely haven't had.
No, but they're very close.
But they haven't had a ton of, like, offensive explosives since the New York trip.
Colorado has 196, so I think they're one back of Colorado.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would suggest you likely to finish well back of some of the best offensive teams in hockey, given what they're generating. But this team's defense is, like, super robust. This team's team-level defense, how difficult it is to score on and break down this team, and even if you do, then you're shooting on Demko, good luck. That's the spine. Like, that's the core of steel behind this team's success this year, and that's reflective of a reinvention of, you know, shedding a bunch of salary in a variety of different ways and spending it on defensively-minded centers, good two-way players, big defensemen. Like that's the story of this team.
And changing the way they play. I thought Kevin Woodley made a great point earlier in the show talking about Ilya Mikheyev and the breakaways, and part of it is his speed, but part of it is also that's just not their identity. They're not looking for that. They're prioritizing a lot of things other than getting those odd man rushes, rush chances.
Zone time in particular, right? So, you know, to me, what we're seeing with the Canucks is at least like a partial version of this, and I think you're right, too, to bring it back to the commitment, the buy-in from Vancouver's best players, because like with Mahomes' tactical retreat to become a more Derek Carr-like game manager. Jesus, that is way too harsh, but
you know
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they ran so many checkdowns. Like, one of the key plays of the night. One of the key plays of the night is that fourth down play in overtime where
he keeps it.
That was cool. But it was a little bit earlier maybe it was the third down play
it was third down.
Where the 49ers send the house and he checks it down to Jerick McKinnon. Like, Patrick Mahomes throws downfield. He's got a receiver one-on-one downfield with a chance to, like, absolutely win the game he's checking down. He's Patrick Mahomes now. Like, that's. So he's bought into playing that way. Vancouver Stars have bought into playing that way. Not obviously at the same level. Mahomes is building a dynasty, but it is an interesting, like, distillation of some of the challenges and decisions that successful organizations face, and the like broad picture of players buying into it, right? But also the tactical choices you have to make to supplement a roster and reinvent yourself and adapt.
Producer Dom Shimati has a correction to issue.
Yes, I looked it up in the official NHL pronunciation guy, Ridley Greig.
Oh.
My apologies.
Thanks. All right. Thanks, Dom.
There you go. Thank you for look at that accountability from Dom Shimati. We'll leave it there. We ended up doing a full segment on Super Bowl talk. That was fun. We had enough hockey tie-ins there. We made it work. So good idea by you, Dom.
Should we do 5 seconds on Thomas's soccer parlays?
No, we should not. I'm really pumping your tires after I was mean to you.
Juventus, come on!
We'll leave it there for today. Tomorrow, another Canucks game day. We will be back on Sportsnet 650.